From the Encyclopedia Podcastica, 2047 edition. In the early days of podcasting, our ancient forebears began the tradition of, during the fifth month of every year, investigating a comic book event featuring the greatest heroes of the DC Universe, the Justice League. The event itself, dubbed JL May, featured the best producers of comic book podcasts. The names are legendary. Podcasting's Michael Bailey, Diablo Frank, those guys with the accents from Waiting for Doom, Comic Reflections, The Lantern Cast, and the Fire and Water podcast. This is, of course, before the events of the Steam War, which eventually led to the great podcast schism of 2022. But that's a story well known and oft told. But a few years before, the groundwork was being laid for the disasters that were to come. It truly was the beginning of the end. Way back in 2016, the subject of that original JL May was, appropriately, JLA Year One. And it was good, well-respected, popular. And in 2017, these top-level podcasters examined the Justice event. Again, to great acclaim. But in 2018, the event was becoming diluted as many lesser podcasters were invited to participate, lowering the overall quality of the event. The DC event covered the Silver Age continues to be held in high esteem, although it was clear that the inclusion of podcasters including, but not limited to, Professor Allen represented a gross misjudgment, an expansion that boded ill for all. For historical context, at that point, the professor was theoretically still the head of the relatively geeky podcast network, before he was squeezed out and the network rebranded as the Just Listen to M, they're the brains behind the operation anyway. Podcast Network. It took a number of years for the Special Investigators Report to be released, and although many indictments were brought, convictions achieved, and scores of years of cumulative jail time served, most analysts believe the problems all stem from the promo that was produced for that 2018 event. After that, nothing was ever the same. Nothing in comic book podcasting, nothing in podcasting itself, nothing on planet Earth was ever the same again.
It's JL May. We're covering the Silver Age.
This JL May. A comic event from Mark Waid.
We're crossovering a podcast. There's 12 of us involved.
Get it in your ear holes, this JL May.
We'll tell you all about the Silver Age. It's not great,
but it's okay.
We really have to warn you. It has a controversial one.
Where Mark Miller wrote the lead.
But it also has some good stuff. Deep thought style, age metal man.
Challenges of the unknown.
Green Lantern, Flash, Patrol of Doom.
The Seven Soldiers of Victory are in there too!
The annual JL May event is upon us once more. 2018, we're reading The Silver Age from 2001. The journey begins in the podcast Justice's First Dawn and continues in the shows Relatively Geeky, Coffee and Comics, Supermates, Waiting for Doom, Idlehead of Diablo, The Long Box Crusade, The Lantern Cast, Batgirl to Oracle, Comic Reflections, Cosmic Treadmill, The Fire and Water Podcast.
Do you know it's JLMay at all?
We checked the date.
It came out in 2000.
We got it right.
And we're ready for some fun.
Do you know it's JLMay at all?
It all begins this May.
Read the books.
Listen to the podcast too.
Read the books.
Listen to the podcast too.
Read the books. Let them know it's JLMay.
Something.
Relatively Geeky presents JLMay 2018, The Silver Age, Challengers of the Unknown. I'm Professor Allen, and welcome to my little bit of 2018's JLMay event of podcasty crossoverness. The subject this year is The Silver Age. This was a 12-part story arc running through a series of one-shot comic books published in 2000. Although each issue was a standalone one-shot with a designation number one on the cover, they do form a larger story arc in which the JLA fights a version of the Injustice League put together by Agamemno, a character created for this event. Many of the books in the event were deliberately created to reflect an aesthetic and storytelling style reminiscent of the Silver Age of comic books. This was mostly thought of as a tribute to books from that era, although a bit of satire can be found as well. And here in May 2018, each of the 12 issues in the series will be covered by podcasters participating in JLMay. As of the release of this episode, assuming the plans of a dozen podcasters go off without a single hitch, which seems, let's go with optimistic, but if all goes according to plan, only Mike, the Peacock at Justice's First Dawn, will have released a JLMay 2018 episode so far. And if you're coming here directly from Mike's show, welcome. We're glad to have you here. And at the end of this episode, I'll tell you where to go to find the rest of the installments and the approximate order in which they'll be released. But first, we have a comic book to cover. And here it is, an all-new tale from the Silver Age, Challengers of the Unknown. This issue had a cover date of July 2000, and a cover price of 250 cents. No, really, that's what it says on the cover. That cover by the legendary Joe Kubert shows our four fantastic heroes back to back in a circle surrounded by dozens of ugly, horrific creatures, including one in black and white striped pants, yellow boots, gloves and cape, and a green top with an hourglass on it, and a white mask with clock hands on it. Like I said, the monsters aren't the only ugly beings on this cover. Holy Hannah! Has Kronos finally robbed the Death Cheaters of their borrowed time? And I joked about Kronos's fashion choices here, but the cover itself is rendered beautifully. The ugly, creepy crawlies have a great Silver Age feel, and the choice of Kubert for this one is terrific. And even at 70-plus years old, the man got it done. The story, A Small Matter of Time, was written by Carl Kiesel, with art by Drew Johnson and Randy Elliott. Ace, Prof, Rocky, Red, these are the men of reckless courage who seek out and defy the unknown. Death means nothing to these heroic adventurers who escaped miraculously from certain doom and dedicated themselves to a second life. They are the men who live on borrowed time. Now let's talk just for a second about the concept of the Challengers and the fact that I'm a total sucker for them. But as I've said many times, I fear that the Chals are on that list of 50s and 60s comic ideas that just might not work in a modern age. The Doom Patrol seems to have been able to survive, mostly by the power of powerful writers. But the Challengers, the Metal Men, and my beloved Adam Strange, they all might just not work these days. But the Silver Age was when they were at their best. So I personally have high hopes for their appearances here in this event, the Silver Age. And it goes without saying that any comic that recognizes that being a professor is a legitimate preparation for superhero-ness, I'm on board for that somehow. On the opening splash page, we get Kronos in a science lab grabbing at the Challengers, who all seem to be about 3 inches high. They're test tubes and beakers that are larger than our heroes. The borrowed time they live on shrinks to zero when they battle the thief of time known as Kronos. Now, the actual story starts with the words, years ago, which is important because these are very, very young versions of these characters, the Challengers of the Unknown. They're in yellow sleeveless jumpsuits with the hourglass design, but this is definitely, like I said, a young take on the team. Years ago, in the Colorado Rocky Mountains, Red scales Challenger Mountain with his bare hands. He does have to get pulled up the last few feet, but he just wasn't going to take the elevator. Very Challengers, he scoffs, very unknown. Or did we change our name while I was gone? Ace chides Red for being so dangerous. After all, he was bringing an important part up the mountains, and if he had died scaling it, it would have taken weeks to reorder that. And shortly thereafter, with the part that he has provided, the superplane, the Galloping Gizmo, is good as new. And Red points out what we're all thinking. Sorry, Ace, but there's only so good she can get with a name like Galloping Gizmo. But this back and forth is interrupted by an incoming transmission, which Prof puts on his large video screen, dubbed the Gigantomatic. For as smart as the Prof is, naming things is not his real big strength. Well, on the screen is Snapper Carr, and if you listen to the first part of this crossover, on Justice's First Dawn, Mike the Peacock told you what all this means, but we'll skip over that little spoiler for now and just cover what we have in this issue. Snapper tells them that while the JLA has split the scene for parts unknown, this is a grim grabber. Because that's how Snapper Carr talks. Well, it turns out that 9 super baddies, Black Manta, Catwoman, Kronos, Dr. Light, Felix Faust, Lex Luthor, Mr. Element, Penguin, and Sinestro, have broken free from prison. And our 4 Challengers of the Unknown respond in the same way that any of us would. By asking who the heck Mr. Element is, and how did he make it into a list of top 10 supervillains, like, really? Seriously? No, that's not what they do. They actually tell Snapper that they have a lead on Kronos. We'll start out there. Their lead is an image of an unknown object over Ivy University. And after a funny bit where the Prof wants to rename the nascent internet the Conglomovox, they head out to old Ivy U. Pack your pocket protectors, people. Whatever that time bandit is up to, I'm betting it isn't on the curriculum. Now look, I'm not here to give notes on Prof's one-liners, But personally, I would have gone with, I'm betting it's not on the syllabus. But look, that's just me. Kronos is busy coveting Professor Hyatt's astonishing time pool. Again, I'm not trying to make this event, this crossover, this episode all about me. But all I have in my office is a nice collection of Dr. Doom figures. I mean, I'm not complaining, obviously, Hail Doom. But having a time pool in the office, that would be kind of cool, too. The Challengers crash through the lab's skylight. Wait a minute. Not only do I not have a time pool in my office on campus, I don't even have a skylight. This comic is showing me just how raw a deal I've gotten from my university. I mean, I do have a really big, nice window and view in my office, so maybe the lack of a time pool and a skylight, I'll just have to get over that. Anyway, after I finish this episode, I'm drafting a strongly worded email to the provost. Well, the Challengers, they do crash in through the skylight, even making a crash course joke on the way because witty banter. But before they can take on Kronos, a ray blasts them, and they become teeny tiny sized itsy bitsy heroes. Which brings us to Chapter 2, Terror of the Towering Time Thief. Our heroes fend off an outstretched hand, complaining that they always seem to get shrunk by their enemies and never changed into anything cool like robots or werewolves. But Kronos wants them to stop. I want to help. You're in great danger. Now, the Chals are a little too smart, little too experienced as superheroes to fall for that old trick. Ace uses a rubber band to fire a super sharp pencil at Kronos, who in his frustration plops a glass beaker on top of Ace. But a rescue attempt frees him, and in his frustration, Kronos slaps away Rocky, firing into a large machine, which makes ominous noises and pings and whirs in response. The tiny Challengers end up surrounding the big guy, but Red has it all figured out. Don't worry, fellas, I can't think of any reason we'd be hurt by the Atom. Ace doesn't quite believe him, but the prof has figured it out too. Kronos has only tried to capture us. He's never tried to hurt us. He even said he wanted to help. And shrinking is out of character for him, and he doesn't have the experience to build a shrinking ray. And then Kronos confirms all of this and gives us the basic template for the Silver Age event. Believe it or not, the minds of the Justice League have been placed in the bodies of their worst enemies and vice versa. He explains that he was hoping to go back in time and prevent this from happening, but right now, they have a bigger problem. Only the Atom's body can withstand prolonged miniaturization. If you Challengers aren't enlarged within 15 minutes of shrinking, you're out of borrowed time. You'll explode. Which brings us to Chapter 3, the last chapter, Future Shock. Before they can worry about the potential explosion of the Challengers in 15 minutes, a bunch of ugly, creepy crawlies jump out of the time pool. When Rocky banged into the machine, the chronometer was changed to 5788. And our little Challengers find themselves under attack from these creatures, one of which is crab-like, one of which is sort of stingray-ish, one is a squid-looking thing. And whatever they are, they want to do more than play. These creatures are simply animals, but they've obviously evolved to function in an extremely predatory environment. Rocky fights one of them off with a pair of office scissors, which are in fact larger than he is. He ends up just punching it, but not to much effect. Red and the prof go after the stingray-looking beast, and they actually are able to take that one down. The plan is to toss it back into the time pool, but the time pool's damaged, and there's not enough time to fix it before the Challenger's time expires. But the Atom figures it out by asking himself, WWCD, what would Kronos do? other than get a better uniform. Anyway, Adam fixes the shrinking ray and drops the tiny challengers into the time pool itself. He's going to place them at the very threshold of time travel, a point that is neither past, present, or future, where time will stand still for you while I fix the shrinking ray. To be fair, that is a pretty clever way to get out of the whole 15 minutes thing. There's no way to know if it will work, but Adam, still dressed as Kronos, which is, again, I can't emphasize this enough, a really bad look. And he drops them into the time pool. If the calculations Prof and I made are correct, they should be at the Techno-Chrono Nexus, as he called it. Adam doesn't need to emphasize this point, but he's pretty sure there's got to be a better name for that. In the, well, let's go with Techno-Chronos Nexus, they see future iterations of themselves, Red wearing an eye patch, Ace with long white hair and a goatee, and then for a panel, we get what I think of as the classic Silver Age challengers, a bunch of slightly older dudes, borderline middle-aged, in purple jumpsuits. And just as Adam pulls them out of the time pool, they also get a glimpse of strange heroes battling the Injustice League. Once restored to their normal size, the challengers and the Atom discuss what they saw. They believe that these heroes are the ones who are going to fix the whole thing. That they're the only ones who can fix this whole thing. But no one's ever seen any of these. Who are they? Where are they? Since that info is unknown, the challengers take it as a challenge. We have to find the only people who can save the planet, Ace proclaims, even if it means scouring the entire Earth. You too, Adam, if you're interested. Count me in. Time's running out. Prof agrees that it is, and the trick is making every second count. And these five heroes head off to find these unknown heroes. Continued. In the Silver Age 80-page giant. The end.
It was a golden age. Our Martian civilization was at the height of its peace and prosperity.
White Martians came from beneath the planet's surface, bringing fire from the planet's guts, and they burned us all.
I lost my family. Came to Earth when my civilization was destroyed.
Detective John Jones is what you might call my human alter ego.
I'm not the only thing from outer space that's come, but right now I'm the only thing that can stop alien invasion.
My name is John Jones.
Also known as the Martian Manhunter.
I'm Mars' sole survivor. There's a reason for that.
I will defend Earth.
The final head of Yabanu. Podcast available through iTunes, Shout Engine, and the Internet Archive.
And we're back. So what did I think of the Silver Age? Challengers of the Unknown. There are multiple ways that this issue or any issue like this in a big crossover has to be analyzed. First, did it work as part of that bigger crossover? And on that measure, I'd say it definitely did. We got the scene with Snapper Carr, setting the scene for what has happened, and then just past the halfway mark, we figure out that Kronos isn't really Kronos, and we get the Atom explaining what happened with the whole body switching thing. And then in the time well, we see these unknown heroes, and at the end of the issue, our heroes are setting out to find those folk. And they're heading right into the finale, the 80-page giant. And so on that technical, might say managerial level, telling this story, this full adventure, while also making sure it fits securely and snugly in the context of the bigger event, I think Carl Kiesel did a fine job with that. That balance can be hard to maintain. We've all read books like this where one of those aspects is emphasized to the detriment of the other, where it's a good standalone that barely touches on the crossover, classically the Red Sky scenario. But we've also seen issues where the crossover overwhelms the issue, and you don't get a full, complete adventure, but merely one part, maybe a chapter, of the long, ongoing story. But again, Kiesel did a good job here maintaining that balance, and that's not always easy to do. And then we do have the level of the issue itself, as a story, as a standalone. How was this reading experience? At first blush, I did not dig the younger takes on the characters, let me start there, that those violate a little bit of the original backstory of the team, as by the time they met, they were all famous adventurers, had a little more life experience and all of that. But that's the biggest quibble I had with the story itself, and it's not that big a quibble. The joke about the prof's complete inability to name things well, that was funny. There were a bunch of other jokes about the internet, how it will never catch on, that I'm sure in 2000 were funny, but 20 years later seem even more prescient. Stuff like, sure, prof, people will sit around all day typing on computers as if. You know, in that scene, nobody actually said, sure, in 18 years, a group of people, most of whom have never met most of the others, are going to record themselves talking about this adventure of ours and of our friends, and people across the globe will listen to these episodes on personal audio players as if. I know, that sounds crazy. Who amongst us could ever see that happening? Now, tying in first Kronos and then the Atom in one character, of course, but tying him into the Challengers makes a lot of sense. I love that choice. Both of their gimmicks are time-related, time thief, borrowed time. That's enough of a connection for me for this to make sense in terms of what we get on the cover copy, and the first half of the story. And then when we transition from Kronos to the revelation that it's really the Atom, although he does continue to wear that hideous Kronos suit, but hey, Silver Age. The Atom was one of that first wave of sci-fi superheroes, so his presence in the Silver Age event makes sense. Working with the Challengers, that makes sense. I just thought all of that worked in terms of, again, matching up the villains and heroes and just, again, that sort of almost managerial aspect of the storyline. Really dug that. The adventure scenes, the fights, the shrinking, all of that worked for me too. And when the Atom and the Chals team up to take on the futuristic beasties, all of that was fun, all of that worked. And the genius of the Challengers' character designs is so simple. Four main leads, one with blonde hair, one with red hair, one with brown hair, and one with black. That's so simple and so smart. And here it works well because we have lots of those fight scenes with multiples of them, and they're all kind of small, taking on the oversized Atom or Kronos, and you can tell who's who. In a team book where the team has a uniform, that's an often overlooked aspect or fact of the art that is, making the characters distinct from one another. Now, I do need to talk about that word I used, Chals, as a shorthand for the Challengers of the Unknown. I used to hate it. And by used to, I mean my entire life up until a few days ago when I started making notes and writing things up for this episode. It's just so much more time-consuming to have to say every time, the Challengers of the Unknown, or even Challengers. Chals is one syllable, as opposed to eight for the Challengers of the Unknown. And certainly from a comic book lettering scenario, six letters is again a much more efficient, effective use of space than more than two dozen letters. Because comic book space is limited. So in putting this episode together, having to speak that team name multiple times, I understand the value of Chals. I don't love it, but I don't hate it anymore like I used to. I do understand its value, and that helps. Again, as an issue, as a story apart from the big event, this worked pretty well, solid read. And then we have that last area to judge, and that is how well this story reminded us of the actual Silver Age. That was the overriding impulse or theme of the series, to tell stories of a Silver Age style with a Silver Age bent to them, to tell quote-unquote lost stories from that era. And here, I do think the results are a little bit more of a mixed bag. I would have preferred, as I sort of already implied, the classic Challengers outfits. These sleeveless numbers do not exactly scream Silver Age to me. As a matter of fact, none of the art screams Silver Age to me, or even whispers it. And I think that's probably my biggest issue with this one. Now, because I was looking forward to reading this issue, and as a duly deputized fan of the Chals, I grabbed my Showcase Presents Challengers of the Unknown Volume 1 a few weeks back and read the first, I think, 7 stories of the team from Showcase and then from their own title. And I really enjoyed those reads. And all of those stories had art by Jack Kirby. And we have talked a lot about the King on this network recently here in the centennial year of his birth. And the art here was fine. It was competent. It was even good. But it wasn't Kirby. And maybe the worst thing, I don't think they even tried. It certainly didn't try to homage Kirby, but I didn't get much sense of Silver Age-iness at all in the art. The best piece of art was the cover by Joe Kubert, another legend. It's dynamic, exciting, attention-getting, and a bit Silver Age-y. But the interior art, not so much. Now, what they did get from those early stories, what they did use, was the sci-fi aspects. So the time pool, the shrinking ray, those events could have happened in earlier stories. There was one that I read from the Showcase where a young alien child, again, who towered over the Challengers in terms of size, took them in and treated them as pets. And so there was a little bit of that going on here with the size differences between them and the Adam/Kronos during that fight. The action of the story fit into what I have recently read about the early Challengers stories. But unfortunately, again, the art, I don't think the art even tried to do that. And that's kind of a disappointment. But for what this issue was trying to do, what the mandate was, all the various masters this story was trying to serve, I think it did a pretty solid job delivering most of those aspects, mostly really well. And I think that's all I have for JL May 2018. But as you know, the event continues from here. Like I said before, Mike the Peacock covered the first issue, Silver Age number 1, over on his show, Justice's First Dawn. And from here, the crossover continues in approximately this order. Secret Files and Origins by Shag and Rob, the Fire and Water podcast. Justice League of America will be covered by the highly caffeinated Clinton Robinson over on the Coffee and Comics show. Teen Titans by Cindy and Chris Franklin, the Supermates. Dial H for Hero by Diablo Frank at the Idle Head of Diablo, a most often Martian Manhunter show. Flash by the team at the Long Box Crusade, which is usually made up of Pat Sampson, Miscellaneous and Various Albrechts, and Delvin, the Dark Web. Green Lantern, hosted by Chad and Mark at the Lantern Cast, a cast about, you know, the Lanterns. Showcase by the one and only Miss Stella at Batgirl to Oracle, a Barbara Gordon podcast. The Brave and the Bold by Nicholas Prom at Comic Reflections. And we wrap up with the Silver Age 80-page giant, which will wrap up the comic series and also the podcast crossover. And that will be covered by Chris and Reggie on Chris and Reggie's Cosmic Treadmill podcast. No pressure, guys. I encourage you to listen to any or all of these podcasts. They all pass inspection and earn the relatively geeky seal of approval. Now, some of you may be new to Relatively Geeky. You may have come here because of the crossover, because you listen to one of those other fine shows, or Fire and Water. So indulge me for a minute or two to tell you about the things we have going on over here. This network, Relatively Geeky, was started in 2013 by myself, Professor Allen, and my offspring, my progeny, my scion, the smarter than me, M. I heartily recommend those shows, the ones that M is on. Those would be the solo show Uncovering the Bronze Age, which only has 10 or so episodes, I think maybe even less than that, but all of them are really good. Now, together, the two of us do Shortbox Showcase, where we talk about concepts or ideas in comics, or just talk about a storyline or a character or a graphic novel. And my main solo show is the Quarterbin Podcast, where I talk about the best comics in the world, cheap comic books. Comics that I literally Stella, literally shag, pay literally 25 cents or less for. Also every month, I put out an episode of the Comics Reading Journal, where I discuss, mostly in brief, every comic I've read during the prior month. I mentioned before that I recently read some of those very early Challengers of the Unknown stories, and you can hear me talk a bit about them on the next Comics Reading Journal for April, which should be the very next thing in this here podcast feed, coming out a week or so after this episode does. All of that and more can be found right here on the Relatively Geeky Podcast Network. And since I'm in self-promotion mode, let me mention the side project that Em and I have called Dorkness to Light, which has its own website and podcast feed. On that show, we talk about pop culture in terms where it intersects with ideas in religion, theology, spirituality. So if you're so inclined, if you're interested in those topics, check us out also at Dorkness to Light. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the rest of the crossover. If you have any questions or comments about this episode, the issue, the crossover, the chals, don't hesitate to contact me. That can be done at relativelygeeky@gmail.com or as a comment on the Facebook or blog post for this episode. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. Again, thank you for listening and have a great day.